Good morning. And here we are with Richard Fagan for this segment of This Strange and Wonderful World. And as any of you know who've been listening, we've been traveling through Antarctica and around Antarctica, both in the past and with a lot of information about that continent. So, and we're going to continue those exploration today with Richard. And good morning, Richard.
Good morning, Carol.
Nice to have you in the studio again today. And what are we going to be doing today?
Well, I promised earlier, or threatened earlier, that we talk a little bit about the photographers who went with Scott and Shackleton, because they were such essential parts of the trips, of the expeditions. And I suppose for everybody who's read something about them, there are 100 or 200 people who've seen some of the pictures. So we ought to know something about the people who took the pictures and what it was like to take pictures under those extreme climatic conditions in the early part of the 20th century.
All right. And reminding our listeners that this is a pre-recorded program. We recorded it in the studio. All of Richard Fagan's This Strange and Wonderful World will be pre-recorded to accommodate his travels, so he can visit family and tell us more wonderful stories about this strange and wonderful world. So with that, let's go ahead and hear about these photographers.
Okay, before we really get started, if you have just a second and have a pen and pencil, pen and paper at hand, would be a good idea to bring them close to where you're sitting or where you're standing, or if you're driving, at least, you know, one hand for the wheel, one hand for the pen and paper, because I'm going to give you in a minute a reference or a couple of references as where you can see some of the photographs of these two great photographers. This is one of the times that I feel it would really be useful if we had a little television segment here, because of course the photographs are worth a thousand words and certainly worth a thousand of mine, and there's no way we can get them to you on the radio. So we're going to talk about these two great photographers who with the two great British explorers of the early 20th century. The man who was with Scott was named Herbert Ponting, and that's spelled P-O-N-T-I-N-G. We haven't said anything about him yet. And the man who was with Shackleton was named Frank Hurley. And when we talked about Shackleton, we did mention Hurley, because when Shackleton's ship, the Endurance, went down, it was Hurley who jumped into the freezing water, into the hold of the ship, to retrieve his, at least some of his photographic materials, his plates, and therefore we have a record of that. Otherwise, everything would have gone down with the ship. Now, there are very good reasons that first-rate photographers were taken by almost all the early explorers. Interestingly enough, with the exception of Amundsen, we have a very thin photographic record of Amundsen going to the pole, being first there. The good reasons were that when these expeditions came back and the primary persons went on tour to talk about their adventures, their achievements, and other aspects of it, they always went along with what were then called lantern slides. Today we'd call them ordinary slides, to make slideshows. And this was a very, very important aspect, not only to spread the word, but also for the expeditioners to make money, because these shows were very, very popular. People paid an entrance fee, and the money went not only to defray some of the expenses, but also this was how these men made their living. And, of course, there were books written, but I would say that the lantern slides, at least initially, were more important than the written record. Now, I said it's a shame we didn't have television. I can't show you any of these pictures, but I'm going to tell you now where you can easily get them. Of course, if you go to Google on your computer and just Google the names of these two men, Mr. Ponting and Mr. Hurley, you would get there sooner or later. You'd find all kinds of references to them and their photographs. But an easy way to get to the photographs is through Wikipedia. I'm sure many of you have used the Wikipedia, People's Encyclopedia. And if you go to Wikipedia and go to their names, Herbert Ponting, for Scott's person, then go to the external links, and on the external links you'll see official Royal Geographical Society print website. At that website, you will see a magnificent display of Ponting's photograph. Do the same with Hurley. You go to Frank Hurley in Wikipedia. Again, you go to external links, and then you go to color photographs of the Imperial Trans-Antarctic Expedition. Now, notice that with Hurley, you're going to color photographs. Hurley took color photographs, and the process had been improved enough in the few years that intervened between Scott's expedition and Hurley's expedition so that his color photographs actually came out. Ponting took color photographs on Scott's expedition, but the dyes were very fugitive, and by the time he got back, what were his color photographs had become black and white photographs. So there's no color record from Ponting. Let's take a quick look at Frank Hurley before we talk about Herbert Ponting, because Ponting was, of the two, the person who left by far the most detailed record of how he took his photographs, how he developed them, the whole way he went about his professional work. Hurley just did the job and didn't talk very much about it. So a little bit about Hurley first. Hurley was an Australian, although he went with the British expedition, of course, and he was born in 1885. He was 15 years younger than Ponting. He ran away from home when he was 14, and he worked on the Sydney docks in Australia, and he bought at that time a box Kodak. The Kodak company had just come out, this is the turn of the century, about 1900, had just come out with their first box Kodaks, the first people's camera. And Hurley fell in love with it, and he taught himself photography. So he was completely self-taught. Now, he had a great spirit of adventure. He attached himself to an Australian by the name of Douglas Mawson. Mawson is a much lesser known character in terms of Antarctic exploration, but he did some amazing things and wrote one of the truly great books about Antarctica, which is called The Home of the Blizzard. Now, Hurley went with Mawson to Antarctica. That was his first experience. Shackleton liked very much what he had seen of Hurley's work with Mawson, and he hired him. He, Shackleton, hired Hurley as his photographer, and so Hurley went south again in 1914 with Shackleton. He was still in his 20s at that time. He took color photos, as I'd mentioned, and he also took movies, saved them, as again I've mentioned, by diving into the hold of the Endurance when it sank, and then he and others, of course, were saved by Shackleton in a story that I told a couple weeks ago. When he returned to Australia, he, in this case, of course, being Hurley, he joined the armed forces. World War II was on, and he became a photographer during World War I, and then again in World War II. So he covered both wars, did brilliant photojournalism during the wars, and died peacefully in bed in 1962. At age 76. He's a classic adventurer, and he seems to have led a rich and very happy life. Now, the Ponting story is quite different in many respects, as you'll hear. He was born, as I said, 15 years before Hurley in 1870, and he was the son of a prosperous bank official. And as a young man, really as a boy, as an adolescent, he fell in love with stories of the American West, cowboy and Indian stories and gold rush stories, all of that. And so he moved to California, an English boy moving to California in 1890s. When he came to California, he worked as a miner. He bought a fruit ranch, that with his dad's money, because he came from a fairly well-to-do family. He failed both in his mining work and as a rancher, and he took up photography. He eventually moved to San Francisco, and he married an American woman. He fathered two children, and then he left his family, abandoned them in 1906, never returned. So he really began his career in the United States. Photography gripped him and gave him a purpose in life that he hadn't had before, and he worked as a photojournalist in Burma, Korea, Java, China, India. He reported on the Russo-Japanese War, which was at the very beginning of the 20th century, and then in 1910, he signed on as the official photographer of Scott's Terra Nova expedition. That was the expedition that we talked about earlier, in which Scott got to the pole and then, with his four companions, died on the way back. Now, he was 40 when that expedition began. At that time, that was considered old for this work because of the rigors of working under Antarctica, Antarctic conditions. Now, I want you to get some feeling for the equipment of the time and the equipment that he took with him. This is not the age of point and shoot. He took two very bulky motion picture cameras with him. He took Eastman 35mm movie film, which had fairly been recently developed at that time, and which, with its various improvements, was the standard film right up through the Technicolor age in Hollywood. He took a developing machine for the movie film, which was roughly the size of a small steamer trunk. He took several still cameras of the kind that we've been familiar with all ever since, really, the Civil War, those bulky ones that use glass plates. His favorite camera was a 5x7-inch reflex of his own design. He was very clever as far as mechanical things went. He had a telephoto lens for this camera, and when that telephoto lens was on the camera, from the back of the camera to the tip of the telephoto lens, it was 3 feet long. And it weighed dozens of pounds. Needless to say, that was not anything that you handheld. It needed a massive tripod to steady it enough to take pictures. And of course, he had with him everything necessary to do his darkroom developing, the chemicals, the trays, etc., and a vast supply of these photographic plates, hundreds and hundreds of hundreds of them. And of course, they were very heavy. Now, for night and low light photography, what he had, and this again goes all the way back to the early days of photography, was magnesium flash powder. You've all seen in old Western movies the photographer lighting off the flashes to take pictures of Robert Redford, etc. But this flash powder actually sat in a shallow tray, rather like we might cook, you know, like a cookie baking sheet or something like that. So if the wind was blowing, it all blew away. So you could only take flash pictures or night pictures in very, very calm weather. I've already mentioned that he did have some color plates with him, but the technology was not sufficiently developed, and they didn't work in the Antarctic conditions. All of the above wasn't light. His kit weighed about 400 pounds. That included some special survival equipment for when he went out, because, of course, to get proper pictures, he would have to stay motionless on the ice, particularly if he was photographing animals, and he has some magnificent animal pictures of seals and killer whales and things like that. And with his out of his 400 pounds of gear, roughly when he went out on one of his photographic expeditions, he'd probably have around 200 pounds with him. So if you think your backpack's heavy, he had 200 pounds, and he would put it on a sled, and he would pull it out to wherever he was taking his photographs, which might be several hours of trudging. He even stayed out overnight sometimes from where the main encampment was. And because everybody else was busy with other things, he really didn't have a photographic assistant, so he really worked alone. There were rare occasions when someone could be spared, and he would take one of those persons out with him. I'm going to read you a little bit from a book of his. He wrote a book when he came back called The Great White South, and it captures very, very well his experience down there and what he did to create a dark room where he could handle both the cinematographic film and the still film on these glass plates. Now, in it, he talks about the hut. And the hut is the way that Scott and his people referred to their main building. It was really not what we'd think of as a hut. It was a rather elaborate building, which they had brought down prefabricated and reassembled in Antarctica. It was 50 feet long by 25 feet wide. It had about 1,200 square feet undercover. So it was the size of a nice-sized, small home. And this is where all the people on the expedition lived, ate, had their recreation, etc. And what happened was that Ponting was given a little corner of the hut in which to set up his darkroom. And this is his description of setting up that and the way it looked. He writes, "During the summer, I built and equipped my laboratory when the weather was too stormy to work outside. It was 8 feet long and 6 feet wide." So we had these 48 square feet of laboratory work. And it was 8 feet high. "After boarding the framework, I covered the walls with rubberoid," which is a kind of rubberized fabric. "And at the end of the bench, a 30-inch lead-lined sink was fitted. On the roof of this room, which was 8 feet below the ridge roof of the hut, a 30-gallon iron tank was fixed that I'd brought for that purpose, and a lead pipe led from that, terminating in a swing tap." All those of you who've ever worked in a darkroom know that it takes quite a bit of water to properly develop pictures, and so this was his water supply. "The fall from the tank to the cap being 4 feet, which gave an ample head of water for rinsing plates. Under the sink were racks for developing dishes, etc. Various things were also stored under the bench, including the cinema developing machine when not in use, and a small carbide gas plant, which generated my own light independent of the hut supply." So what he had was really gas light in there to illuminate it. But of course, he had a little safety light, red light, the way even modern darkrooms have.
Are there any pictures of his darkroom at all?
Yes, there are pictures of his darkroom.
It sounds fascinating.
Yeah, it was just a tiny little space. He writes, "Every available inch of storage space was utilized, even the ceiling being covered with racks in which photographic gear was stored. My bed was so arranged that it could be folded up in the daytime against the lower part of the wall on the opposite side of the bench, where it was out of the way." In other words, this was not only his dark room, it was his little cubbyhole where he lived and slept. "To obtain water, I would go out daily and get ice from the little glacier, or glacier, as they called it, glacier at the foot of Wind Vane Hill, and I'd melt it down in a cooler on the stove, then mount a ladder, empty the water into the tank through a funnel. Thus, I always had plenty for photographic purposes if used with care. The sink drained into a pail, which was emptied when necessary." And now, this is the part that I love. Again, those of you who've worked in darkrooms know how fussy photographic work is as far as temperature. I know when I was a kid and I had a little darkroom, I was always sticking the thermometer in the trays to make sure that it was just 76 degrees and et cetera, et cetera. So here's how Ponting described the temperature problem in his hut. Remember, we're in Antarctica. "I've stated that my darkroom was at the eastern end of the building. Whenever the door was closed, as was necessary when developing or changing plates, it became exceedingly cold. As no warmth could enter, the temperature would drop rapidly to about 36 degrees Fahrenheit. Foreseeing the likelihood of difficulty in heating my room, I brought a small oil stove for the purpose. But I presented the stove to the sailors of the Terra Nova, as their mess room in the ship was inadequately heated." In other words, he brought his stove to do his photographic work, but being the good guy that he was, he gave it to the sailors because they were cold in their mess room. He continues, "For lack of sufficient warmth when the door was closed, the lower part of the wall at the end of my room speedily became a mass of ice, due to warm air condensing on the cold wall. I had to chip this baby glacier away with an ice pick whenever it became 6 inches thick, which it did once a week throughout the winter." So, Now he talks a little bit about developing the movie film, which I actually found the most astounding thing, never having developed any movie film, always having sent it to Kodak. But he's down here in these early days. Remember, it's 1910, 11, and he's developing movie film. The developing of movie film was a continual and dreary chore. A great amount of monotonous work is entailed in developing cinematographic film in these latitudes. On account of the difficulty of getting sufficient water, the tank system cannot be used. Therefore, films have to be developed, fixed, and washed in strips of 50 feet on a revolving drum, by which method the necessary quantity of the solutions or of water is reduced to the minimum, but it is exceedingly slow. 50 feet of film lasts for less than a minute on the screen, but to develop, fix, and wash that quantity of negative film took about an hour and a half. As several thousand feet of film had been exposed in the summer, it took well over 100 hours during the winter to develop and wash these negatives. These were dried by hanging them up in the hut on frames. In addition, there were many hundreds of glass negatives to be developed, so as space in the ship had not permitted my bringing an assistant, time never hung idly on my hands. So that's his darkroom, and if you ever get a chance to see the quality of this photographic film and the cinematographic film that he did, please remember the conditions under which it was developed. And now he's going to talk a little bit about what it was like to go outside in this weather and take pictures. He says, when working the camera, I would remove both pairs of mitts until my hands began to chill in the woolen gloves. So what he had on was mitts and then woolen gloves inside. Then I'd bury them again in the warm fur, beat them together until they glowed. But my fingers often became so numbed that I had to nurse them back to life by thrusting my hands inside my clothing. Once thoughtlessly, I held a camera screw for a moment in my mouth. It froze instantly to my lips and took the skin off when I removed it. On another occasion, my tongue came into contact with the metal part of one of my cameras while moistening my lips as I was focusing. It froze fast instantaneously. To release myself, I had to jerk it away, leaving the skin of the end of my tongue sticking to the camera, and my mouth bled so profusely that I had to gag it with a handkerchief. Now, those of you who've worked in cold climates know that even modern lubricants tend to get sort of sludgy and thick. For instance, in really cold climates, you have to preheat diesel oil very often because it just doesn't flow properly, you know, at 40 or 50 below. He had the same problem with his cameras because the cameras, of course, were lubricated. And nothing was electronic, of course, it was all mechanical. And then he closes this by talking a little bit about how he took care of these cameras. Photographing in such extremely low temperatures necessitates a great deal of care. There are many pitfalls, into all of which I plunged headlong. I had to pay dearly for some of the experiences I gained. Remember that he hadn't been to Antarctica before. Unlike Hurley, who had gone with Mawson, this was his first time. Ponting's first time. He says, I found that it was advisable always to leave the cameras in their cases outside the hut. There was sometimes a difference of more than 100 degrees between the interior and exterior temperatures. To bring cameras inside was to subject them to such condensation that they became dripping wet as they came into the warm air. If for any reason it was necessary to bring a camera indoors, all this moisture had to be carefully wiped away. The greatest care had to be taken to see that none got inside a lens. To do so much as breathe upon a lens in the open air was to render it useless, for it instantly became covered with a film of ice that could not be removed. It had to be brought into the warm air, thawed off, then wiped dry. And every trace of oil had to be removed from all working parts of the cinema cameras and focal plane shutters, as even some non-freezing oil, in quotation marks, which I bought in Switzerland, froze. Lubricating had to be done with graphite. So we used basically graphite powder to lubricate. So, after Scott and his companions set out for the pole, and Ponting, of course, couldn't go with him, he took the pictures of them departing, but then there was no reason for him to stay around for the trip. And Ponting and 8 other men sailed back to England on the Terra Nova when the Terra Nova came to resupply them. So he was not there when Scott didn't return, when the party that went out and looked for Scott returned. So we have none of Ponting's photographs of that particular first moment of realization of the tragedy. Now, he took with him back to England not only the cinematographic film, but about 1,700 photographic plates. So he had a vast record. He also returned to massive debts, and he was counting on these photos to earn money. He had never been good with money. He always managed to get himself in debt. Whatever he turned his hand to, whether it was the fruit farm or the mining, it just never worked out. So he had borrowed money to equip himself for this trip. It wasn't paid for by Scott's people, and he was counting, as I say, on selling the rights to all of this and doing slideshows of his own. But tragedy stalked him too. Scott, and I read from this when we talked about Scott, wrote a very eloquent diary. And the focus, when word got back to England that Scott and his companions had died, was on that, and the heroic and the tragic aspects of it. And this eloquent diary and the ensuing national explosion of sorrow bypassed Ponting and trumped his plans. Nobody wanted to see his photographs. Nobody wanted to see his lantern slides. They wanted to see Scott's lantern slides. They didn't want to see the photographer out there. And he was not able to make any money or pay off his debts. And furthermore, because he was such a rotten businessman, he managed to lose the rights to his, well, the rights belonged to the expedition as such, and he wasn't successful in getting access to those rights to the still photography. So now he's left basically with massive debts and the cinematographic film to which he retained the rights. Now, finally he published a photographic narrative of the expedition under the title The Great White South. It was from that publication that I read earlier about his darkroom and his use of the cameras and his care of the cameras. But as I mentioned, he retained rights only to the motion picture film. So he figured that if he was going to do something with his materials, it would have to be in cinema. It wouldn't be in still film. And he made a documentary film, again, borrowing money to do it, and it was issued as The Great White Silence. He had to go with an existing motion picture company in order to both get the equipment to produce a documentary like that, but also to market it. And it was for him an absolutely disastrous, it was more than unpleasant, it was sort of catastrophic experience. He hated going with these commercial people. He hated his collaborators who were necessary because he couldn't do it again. And he wrote about them later. He said, "A lot of selfish, conceited, incapable invertebrates, charlatans of colossal conceit and incredible incapability." So this too was not a happy experience. So back he goes. He still has rights to the film, and he borrows more money, and he remade the film in the 30s. It's now 20 years after the events, and basically he has done very little in those 20 years that was noteworthy except to struggle to get this film out. So he remade the film, adding a soundtrack because sound movies had come in, and some animation to show the maps and the various tracks of the expedition. And the film was finally issued in 1933. So we're 22 years after the expedition. He is no longer a young man. It was issued as 90 Degrees South. It had cost Ponting £10,000, which, of course, at that time, 1933, it's the Depression, that's a prodigious amount of money. I mean, today the equivalent would certainly be many hundreds of thousands of dollars. It was a critical success, but again, Ponting's luck, it was not a commercial success. By the way, this movie, 90 Degrees South, is available on video. I have no idea whether Netflix has it or, you know, if it's around, but it is, and it is absolutely fascinating and worth watching. It includes both a few stills, but mainly it's motion picture film taken in 1911. He wrote after the film came out, he was hoping, of course, for a commercial success. He said, "I have done my utmost, but the film has ruined me, for I am run down physically as well as cleaned out financially. I am dropping out of photography for good, as I am so sick of the sort of people one has to rub shoulders with in the film business." Within 2 years, he was dead. He was 65 years old. And his great lifetime achievement, of course, was this magnificent photographic record. It never really brought him happiness. It certainly never brought him financial success, but it left an absolutely indelible record of one of the classic, probably one of the two most classic of the expeditions to Antarctica during the heroic age. You may remember that last month I talked about The Worst Journey in the World and the book written by Cherry Garrard about the three heroic explorers, two of whom died with Scott on the way back from the pole, who went out looking for the emperor penguin eggs. And Cherry Garrard was, of course, a magnificent writer, and he wrote about Ponting, what I think is the most memorable tribute to him. So Cherry Garrard wrote, and we'll close with this. "He, Ponting, came to do a job, and he did it well. Here in these pictures is beauty linked to tragedy, and the beauty is inconceivable, for it is endless and runs to eternity." So that's it.
Quite a story. That's amazing. In its own way, as amazing as the explorers. And I'm going to make it a point to call the photographers on the island and make sure they tune
they,
in.
They listen to this.
The ones I know, anyway. Yeah.
I don't know if I, you know, mention this, but I title this "Before Point and Shoot" with, you know, a little bit of irony in my voice when I see that. Because basically, I think when most of us, and I'm, you know, I'm in my mid-70s. I can remember my first camera, and never, I suppose, did a camera that I had weigh, they were all under 2 pounds, even the early ones. And certainly by the time we got to 35 millimeter cameras, even with fairly long lenses, it was probably only a 2 pound camera case and that lens. And here this guy is lugging around his 400 pounds of gear in that frozen. And you know, when we made our trips to Antarctica, Carol, of course, we'd see really high-end camera stuff. We'd see people with these Canon 500 millimeter lenses that cost, I don't know how many thousands of dollars, but lots of thousands of dollars, things like that. And you'd see people taking, and I've seen some of the pictures they took, some of them really extremely good pictures. But I think it's fair to say, except for the color work and what color work adds, that the best of the black and white pictures taken subsequently to what Ponting and Hurley did. It's like talking about Ansel Adams and things like that. I mean, who does black and white work on mountains better than, or Yosemite, than what Ansel Adams did decades and decades and decades ago? And the same thing, I think, is true of these guys. Part of it is that huge format camera. So They didn't have, you know, 6 million pixels, but they had a lot of resolution right. in those cameras. And we've even seen it, what, if you go back to Brady's pictures of the Civil War, a full 50 years, almost 50 years before this, there are pictures out of that portfolio that have maybe been equaled but never surpassed as war photography.
Yeah, it's amazing. A piece of that, as we know, is the art of the photographer. As beauty is in the eye of the beholder and what they see through the frame. But the other thing that amazes me is, the information that around the technology developed as the technology developed. So people were no longer working in a climate of the first, not knowing anything.
Yeah.
And these people, they had no idea what conditions would be, how this was going to work. They had no idea. And yet they persevered and were immensely successful.
One thing that has to be taken into consideration, and in no way diminishes what they did, is that if you want your images to be preserved after you've taken them, it is much better to be in a very cold place than a very hot place, because all the chemical activity is slowed way down. And in fact, I know when I got fairly serious about photography, I was always only an amateur, of course, I was advised that when I was living in the Caribbean, always keep my film in the refrigerator, right? Always, and have it developed as quickly after you expose it as possible, because the weather and the humidity is not good for it, etc. So I think it's true to say that if at the same time these people had been working in, let's say, extremely difficult conditions at the other end of the climatological spectrum,
right,
in the Amazon, for
right,
instance,
around, the equator.
around Manaus, yeah. or someplace like that, that they wouldn't have been able to achieve portfolios of this magnificence, because the weather would have done them in.
Well, I look forward to going home and get on Wikipedia and looking at some of this remarkable history. And indeed, it was a heroic age.
Absolutely. And you know what we're going to do the next time that we record one of these is we're going to talk about the post-heroic age. Because really, with the First World War and with what happened in Europe at this time, and after all, this was largely, not exclusively, the work of Europeans, British and Scandinavians, Antarctica sort of dropped off the map at the same time that air technology reached the level where you could begin to explore by air.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have an interwar period in which the most dramatic events as far as exploration and mapping and science in Antarctica were really carried on by air. And Richard Byrd, the great aviator and explorer of Arctic regions, figures in that story. But these kinds of stories that we've been telling to this point, this epoch, if you will, of the heroic imperial expeditions, ends with the First World War. After that, it's different. And we'll talk about that next time.
Well, I certainly look forward to it. And thank you so much, Richard, for being in our studio. And this has been a pre-recorded program of This Strange and Wonderful World, and I look forward to being back with Richard in the studio on March 16th, I believe it'll be, with that story of the post-heroic age. And this is KLOI-LP, Lopez Island, Washington, 102.9 FM, and we're going to return you to some pre-recorded music here.